Welcome to Metropolitan Journal. I'm James Clapp.
Dear kindly Sergeant Krupsky, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing upsy that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunk. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupsky, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside, there is good.
The fictional officer Krupke, immortalized in Stephen Sondheim's lyrics from West Side Story, seems quaint in the context of contemporary police-community relations. Krupke stands in a long line of varying caricatures of the American cop, from the bumbling blue coats of Max Sennett comedies to the pot-bellied rural sheriff to the kindly neighborhood beat cop to the bay-shirted bashers of Rodney King. The elusive truths of American policing lie deeply embedded in the often contradictory features of the American character. Our expectations of the police and their expectations of themselves are often mirrored in these caricatures. Are they the thin blue or beige line between us and the unlawful? Or have they too often stepped over the wrong side of that line themselves? The answer isn't readily available, but recent events in several communities have signaled a growing police-community relations problem. In San Diego last March, emotions ran high in citizens' testimony at a police community review board hearing.
We believe the police brutality was politically motivated. We did not say or do anything to cause them to act violently. The brutality occurred in a middle-class tourist park outside of the community where police violence is common. Their attack was clearly premeditated. This was an attack on our First Amendment rights to free speech and assembly. They stopped our march to intimidate us and discourage continued dissent against the war in the Middle East. The blatant brutality we witnessed was just as terrifying as the Los Angeles police brutality, which happened the same day. But because we have no video to show, the event has been ignored. There is something wrong with a system that allows this kind of brutal brutality to continue unchecked.
Those sentiments are bad news for police, and bad news travels fast, especially when it happens before video cameras. Like most big city police forces, San Diego has had its share of incidents, whether related to crowd control at political rallies or in the use of deadly force, that have injured relations between the police and the community. However, there's another aspect of police work, perhaps less newsworthy, but according to its proponents, potentially capable of forging a positive relationship between the police and the public. And it may make police work more effective and efficient as well. San Diego Police Chief Bob Bergreen explained problem-oriented policing at a meeting with residents of the San Carlos neighborhood.
For years, we've had this type of approach. Let's say we've got a problem area, kids hang out, they sell drugs, out of one house in the neighborhood, and you've seen these houses. We'd come in, maybe we'd send somebody in undercover, we'd bust two or three people, we'd handcuff them, we'd haul them off to jail, they'd bail out, get no prison sentence. Tomorrow they're back there selling drugs again, we're back there, you're calling, we're trying to solve the same problem again by dragging them off to jail again. They go to jail, they come back, they go to jail, they come back, the problem goes on and on. Problem-oriented policing says, don't just try to solve a problem by putting handcuffs on it. There are other things you can do, such as, okay, maybe it's a rental house, and so you go to the person who owns the house and you say, you know, these kids are selling dope at your house, why don't you evict them? We have found a lot of people who will, because if they won't, then here's what we do. We go to the next step. The next step is we go to the city attorney and we say, we have arrested people at this house 14 times for selling drugs. We've contacted the owner of the house and asked them to evict them. They won't do it. This is a public nuisance. We'd like to abate this house. How do you abate a house? You take plywood and you nail it to the windows and doors, and you evict the people, and no one can go in. If it's worse than that, if it's a fire hazard, we bulldoze it flat. We've bulldozed one house flat in the city already since we started problem-oriented policing, and we've nailed up a lot of houses. What generally is happening now is the property owners realize we know how to play this game. We are serious. They go in and make the changes that we suggest they make. To say it's a police department program is true because we started the ball rolling. But the city manager jumped on that, and it is now a citywide program. Part of problem-oriented policing is the city attorney's office, is litter abatement, is building inspection, is fire through the fire code, the health department. We bring anybody we can that will fit to solve a neighborhood problem, because it's back to the quality of life issue.
Officer Andy Mills is one of Bergreen's problem-oriented policing, or POP, training officers. Mills gave as an example of how POP works a project which he and his partner, Gay Wagner, undertook in the Skyline Meadowbrook area of East San Diego.
And an example of that is Skyline Meadowbrook. We had gang members hanging out there for years, and we've done tactical action plans, we've done SWAT type things, you know, major sweeps, the LAPD hammer type thing, SED crushes it. We've done video surveillance. We've done virtually everything you can possibly imagine. And this is over a long-term period. When I first came on as a trainee, I went with my FTO to Skyline Meadowbrook just to see all the gang members so I could learn what gang members are. I mean, this is how inundated that place was. And anybody who's come on our department has understood this. Rather than just responding to it, my partner and I got sick of responding there every day, two or three times a day, 50 gang members hanging out, have the helicopters swoop overhead and protect us and that type of thing. We sat back and we tried to think through why they were there. And so we asked two questions of ourselves. A, what do I need to know about the problem? And then B, where do I go to get the information? What we established is it's a community problem, that needs to be dealt with by the community. The police have been trying for years and have been basically unsuccessful in eliminating the problem or even reducing it to a manageable level. And it's not that we lack of trying. We're good at what we do. We've put lots of people in jail off that corner, but that alone wasn't doing it, especially with the overcrowded court systems and the jails and all the other things that go with it. What we wound up doing was doing a survey to analyze the problem. We went door to door in plain clothes and knocked on the doors, and this is just after, if you'll remember, the deadly force issue here in San Diego. So there were some really tense, hostile feelings in the community. We thought we'd get basically butchered going to the doors, and people, you know, not really wanting us and liking us, and that's one of the reasons we were in plain clothes. We found exactly the opposite. We knocked on the doors, and rather than, as soon as we identified who we were and what we were doing, rather than people answering our questions real curtly or briskly or not answering at all, every last one of the people pulled us into their houses and said, let me tell you what's going on. And the intelligence we delivered was unbelievable. Based on the results of the survey, we started our response.
Officer Gay Wagner pulls her black and white into the parking lot of the small neighborhood center at the Skyline Meadowbrook intersection. A couple of young men walk slowly away from the lot, but there's no sign of any gang activity. Wagner is equally enthusiastic about POP and is a department spokesperson for it to community groups. Surveying the placid intersection, she rehearses how she'll explain POP to a group later in the day.
The logic behind POP is similar to an ancient test of insanity. A subject is put in a room with a water faucet, a pail is under the water faucet, and he's given a ladle. And his job is to bail the pail. And when the test starts, the water's turned on, he's sitting there with the ladle and the pail. If he first turns off the water before bailing the pail, he was deemed sane. If he just bailed the pail without turning off the water, he was deemed insane. Well, we're in the position many times of just being given a ladle to bail a pail, and we don't have any control in our workday, and the traditional system that we're used to doesn't allow us to try to control the faucet. POP gives us an opportunity. It gives us the time that's sanctioned by administration to try to deal with the faucet, because the way that they look at it is, if we're going to 6211 Alderley three times a day, that means, because like on a typical beat like this 412, we've got one car that's covering probably 5 to 10 square miles. So the citizens of this beat are not getting very good service if we spend X amount of our day at one address.
Wagner tells the story of Skyline Meadowbrook's almost legendary 12-year routine of gangs, drugs, drive-by shootings, and muggings. She attributes the breaking of that cycle to a POP project she and Mills undertook.
We were intimidated by the problem, partly because of how long the problem, I mean, everybody that came out to Southeast, like when our sergeant just came out in the field last year and we had a new lieutenant and everything, every time everybody said, oh, Skyline and Meadowbrook, oh, that's been a problem for years. You know, I can remember getting shot at there. I can remember this. I can remember that. So we're thinking, you know, how are two of us going to impact a problem that's been going on for 12 years? And the other thing is, we saw so little visible community support, or even, you know, like I say, we had the clinic calling all the time, the liquor store, and we had one neighbor over here. So to us, that didn't really say that the neighborhood was fed up with this as a problem. And we really felt like if we were going to tackle it, we knew it was going to take a lot of time and energy, and we were willing to do it if the neighborhood perceived it as serious a problem as we did, and if they were willing to back us on what we might have to do. So that's when the questionnaire came into play. We went door to door to 51 homes and were amazed at the reception that we got. Everybody had much to say.
Confident that the residents were indeed concerned, Wagner and Mills turned this information into simple but effective actions. They had trees that were blocking surveillance trimmed, improved the lighting, had payphones used for drug deals removed, and got a local store to stop selling drug paraphernalia. Wagner even delivers paint to residents to paint over the gang graffiti on their walls and fences. But probably more important was that the POP process helped the residents to understand that the police wanted and needed their assistance. But to gain that assistance, their fear of contacting the police needed to be alleviated. Andy Mills.
The main factor that we identified was fear. The people were afraid to go out of their houses, afraid to go to the store at the corner where these juvenile delinquents were hanging out, adult delinquents, either one. They were afraid to leave their homes. They were afraid to say anything. They were afraid to call the police. Many people would say they would hear shots fired on a nightly basis and not call the police because what good would it do? By the time the cops get there, 7 minute delay, you know, typical, you know, standard response time, they'd be gone. Or they'd be there, the gun would be ditched, or they'd be there armed and turned into a firefight, and they just didn't want to be any part of that. So they were really reluctant to employ the police services in the area. They just didn't feel it would help. And then the remote possibility, which was a great fear, that the police would come to their door after they called and tell them things are okay, we've got it under control. That would identify who called, and people are just deathly afraid of the retaliation. In fact, one person has a car firebomb there for trying to interact with the police in the past. So we tried to identify what the factors were. The main factor was fear for the people. They identified several other things that were a nuisance to them that would help eliminating the fear, and so we dealt with it from that perspective. One of the first things we did was explain to people their rights as far as calling the police. They don't have to tell the dispatcher who they are. And we also explained to them if they dial 911, it'll automatically lock in with an address and a name on the computer system. And we explained all those facets to them, and they were relieved to know that, and were very appreciative. And some interesting things happened that we'll share a little bit later with you as a result of that. But the people were much more understanding that they can give their name and request an officer not contact them. And the officers are told that over the air, do not contact RP, the reporting party. And so they took a burden off them that they could call in confidence and not be contacted.
For both Mills and Wagner, a major satisfaction in applying the principles of problem-oriented policing is that they have not only made a connection with the neighborhood, but they've also brought the neighborhood together. Wagner's sense of satisfaction in that is evident from the results of the neighborhood cleanup she and Mills organized.
We had a community cleanup. The PTA came up and sold hot dogs and refreshments. People came in and they swept and they raked and they trimmed leaves and they hauled away trash and they painted the graffiti over. And at the end of the day, it really looked great. And everybody was so excited because the other thing was, you know, they never really had like a neighborhood get together here. And during this whole process, people have become friends in this neighborhood. Kathy will tell you that before all this whole business started, she didn't know anybody up here. She didn't have any friends up here at all. She was considering moving out of the neighborhood because she literally came home at night, locked herself behind her bars, and that was it. She didn't know who sold drugs. Nobody else did. In fact, people who came to the initial meetings when they were describing one house that they sold drugs turned out to be hers. And she was absolutely, she was so upset. she's like, no. And she's taught, and then she started, she said she wasn't there, and she didn't, during the day, and she didn't know who hung out, but she knew that people had been around because she'd find trash and everything. And, you know, so she told us, and she told them, you know, anybody on my property, get them off. And now she's got some really good friends up here, and we've had a couple of events where people have really gotten out to know each other, and there have been a lot of new friendships forged here that didn't exist prior to this process, which also means people are looking out for each other a lot more.
Mills cites a more specific change in police community relations, which he attributes to their POP project.
Let me tell you a neat story. Ron Davis was killed less than a mile from where our POP project was. As a result of our POP project, the people were just distraught over it. I got phone calls from many of the people involved in the community group saying, you know, we're sorry for your friend's death. What can we do to help out? They were as distraught as we were over the loss of a family member. And I've never witnessed that before in my 10 years as a police officer. I've been a cop, since 1977. And on their own initiative, they called the Police Officers Association, drew a check out of their personal account, the group's personal account that they raised through fundraisers and job fairs and things like that, wrote a $100 check from their account to the Ronald Davis Family Fund to see that his kids get educated, since he won't be around to do that. I thought that was incredible.
Dr. Robert Coates of the National Crime Prevention Council is giving one of the seminars at the second National Conference on Problem-Oriented Policing. This year, it's in San Diego.
Until each of us recognizes we sit in this room as a cross-cultural, multi-ethnic, bilingual, polychrome group of folks, recognize that our destinies are tied together. Your destiny is tied with my destiny, and that if we're ultimately to bring a change about and forming partnerships to make our communities a better and safer place to live, we must have a shared mission.
Coates combines a sociological perspective on crime with an almost evangelical delivery. He's a believer in POP, and he's out to make more converts from the cops who fill the room to standing room only. After his lecture, he's more relaxed, but just as firm in his conviction that POP is the direction in which contemporary policing must go.
When we talk about community-oriented policing, and I put POP as a subcategory within that, if you remember the officer on the beat that our mothers knew, who was concerned about how we were doing and who spent time going into the businesses and who was more than a person of law enforcement. And we could go back to the West Side Story and talk about
Officer Kropke.
Right. That was community-oriented policing. It was the heart breath of what was going on. What's different about it is we went to program-oriented policing, which got into supply reduction as opposed to demand reduction being a prevention activity. And so it meant going from a program, which you had addressed, of pulling your guns out, how many officers can we put here, taking you off of a beat, putting you in a patrol car, not having one where you walked around and had that interpersonal contact anymore, and where it changed from week to week or shift to shift, to a philosophy that says we cannot hire enough officers. It's impossible. And that what we need to do is that we need to begin to develop, and that's why I talk about partnerships so much. We need to get that back to what was happening in the streets before.
How does a police officer, a beat officer, how can you relate to, though, let's say we say that it's strong family values and other kinds of things, how does he intersect to that? He may understand that, but wonder how it relates to what he does on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think in part what you see here in San Diego and what happens when you go down to the sub of community-oriented police and you look at the POP concept, when you look at how they do the training through this CERA model, the officer comes in, they brainstorm about what the problems are, you have multi-jurisdictions that come in and recognize, you know, I'm not in this alone, we've addressed some of these same issues. They work out basically a plan or strategies to address that. And the officer really goes out there equipped with something that he couldn't put on his hip, that he couldn't write in a book, that he puts, and that's the philosophy that he puts in his mind and his heart that helps him approach the situation he's faced with daily.
414 Baker, can I have a 29 on 2, John Yellow Paul, 261?
I asked Andy this question the other day, just about sort of the
personal and professional satisfaction that you get out of something like the pop that you get out of Skyline and Imperial? What? How do you feel about that? There are reasons that you came in, I suppose, that you did, that you came into law enforcement work. How does it register with you?
220th Street, right?
Well, I'll tell you, there's nothing more frustrating than getting called to the same spot every day and not really having tools to deal with the problem. And then you get, you know, the business owners coming to you or the neighbors coming to you like, you know, you're the police, can't you do something? And you feel like an idiot, you know, because you can't really do a lot. And
so this has kind of expanded your arsenal a little bit.
Yeah, it's expanded our arsenal, and it's also, so, you know, that hour or an hour and a half every day that we spent there just dispersing people was just like a drop in the bucket. It didn't really have any impact on the problem per se. So when the department gets behind you and says, okay, look, we're willing, they gave us, they traded us days so that we could do like the survey. So that took one whole day that we weren't on regular patrol. We were doing a survey. They gave us time that we could devote to the community meetings. So they had to, they invested in us and our time for a considerable amount at the beginning while we investigated the problem and we came up with some solutions for dealing with it. So they had to be willing to give us the time and energy, or the time. We had the energy if we could get the time. You just can't do that without some process set up, because routinely, you know, you're driven by your radio calls and whatever presents itself to you. And so with that time, you know, we ended up dealing with our biggest frustration every day with Skyline and Meadowbrook, because it seems such a futile effort to just kind of drive in, shoo people away. And all of a sudden, after, you know, the months of time and working with the neighbors, we were actually able to have a real impact on that problem. And that problem doesn't exist as it did when we started. And the other thing is we now have a lot of friends in the community that we never had. I tried to shoo some people off right beside the church lot there one night a couple months ago. There was a guy that I had arrested for rock cocaine a few nights earlier was standing there with two other guys, and they were drinking beer right on top of a no lawyering sign. I stopped and I said, you can't be here, get out of here. And they said, no, we live in that house right there, you can't tell us where to go. And I said, okay, you live in that house right there? And they said, yeah. And I said, okay. I said, what's your name? I said, because I'm going to check. And they're like, no, you can't go in there and check. I said, yes, I can. And I went in, and it turned out to be friends of a man's son who lives there. But the man was one of the guys on our, in the Recycle Skyline group. And he said to me, he said, you got a problem with anybody on my property? He said, as far as I'm concerned, Officer Wagner, you can tell them, and you can get, tell them to leave my property anytime that you think it's a problem, and I'll back you. I'll tell you, I didn't have that a year ago.
Skeptics will doubtless view problem-oriented policing as another PR gimmick to offset incidents of police misconduct, excesses, or other bad press. And even proponents of POP will admit there are officers and administrators who will view it as a police foray into social work. POP proponents seem aware of these concerns, but they're also aware that police work must expand into consideration of the underlying causes of the public's disenchantment with its traditional modes of operation and with its inefficiencies. In this respect, law enforcement may be closing ground with other societal institutions, such as health, environment, and social policy, by acknowledging that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Metropolitan Journal is produced by Danny Shapiro. The associate producer for Problem-Oriented Policing was Renata Zakerdla. We had additional production assistance from Andrea Seisma and Jenna McDonough. Coming up in our next half hour of Metropolitan Journal, do the Orchids and Onion Awards deserve an orchid or an onion? Stay tuned for news for National Public Radio.